Accession number 17394, Reel 4.
Admiral Garrett's Reel 4.
On the front at Sassy, and there is in fact a hotel now in that position. It's the old Victoria Barracks, and we sat there for about 9 hours, as I recall. And again, the system was working. We'd been issued with a cup of tea and some biscuits before we left camp. After 3 hours, we received a cup of tea and some biscuits. And at some suitable interval thereafter, we received another cup of tea and some biscuits. And the system was so good, I think it would have gone on for days if this. What it would have done to our insides, I don't know. But I do remember the Royal Ulster Rifles, I think, were equipped with bicycles to exploit their mobility when they got to the other side, and I remember seeing them set off to go to their loading position and then seeing them return about 6 hours later, and we were eventually returned to our camp without going any further. There is one other aspect to this which is of importance, and that is that there was a parade, perhaps something to do with the British Legion, during the time I was at liberty in Portsmouth, going about my duties. And I remember that people stood around and cheered as the British Legion, or whatever it was, marched past. We marched through the streets of Portsmouth to go to a loading position in the dockyard, and nobody looked at us. And this is something which others have mentioned. Men told me when they got over to the other side that they'd been parked outside people's houses in Gosport and thereabouts, waiting to move forward to their loading positions, and nobody spoke to them, nobody came out. Nobody gave them tea or anything like that. And this was because the rules were you must keep it all quiet. And the moment that the announcement was made at 7 o'clock in the morning that the Allied forces had landed in Normandy, people were rushing out with teapots and cake and whatever they could to offer to the troops. But it was this strong sense of national discipline that we all knew it was going to happen. We didn't know exactly when, but the great thing was not to give anything away. And it's hard for people to imagine, because the size of the Mulberry Harbour units are difficult to encompass without physically seeing them, and yet there were these great Odeon cinema-sized buildings being produced at various creeks and inlets around the coast, and people didn't ask what they were, or if they did, they didn't get an answer. And it's this lack of confidentiality which so many of us find distasteful today, that nothing is kept confidential. I've heard people who were involved in the cryptographic service at Bletchley Park say, "But I never told my husband what I did during the war. My wife and I worked in organisations which were related at one time in the post-war period, and we both had access on a particular list of intelligence access, and we neither of us said that we had this access until many years later, when it was suddenly broadcast, I think in Parliament, that there was a thing called SIGINT, and all that had been previously secret became literally broadcast, and GCHQ and secret intelligence became an open matter for everybody. I've got us now to the stage where we're poised on the 5th of June. It was postponed, as you remember, the weather was too bad. So, in fact, my army colleague and I gathered at HMS Vernon, where we were with, by a happy chance, the same team that I had trained with in Scotland in the support group. We were going to go across in LCH 185, which was a landing craft infantry converted to a minor command ship role, and the officer in that ship was Commander Neville Curry, who was deputy senior officer of the assault group, and he was going to lead the 4th AS column behind the minesweepers. I'd omitted to mention one group which is very important, and that is the cavalry unit we had, which was the 13th, 18th Royal Hussars, were equipped with DD tanks, that is duplex drive tanks. They had flotation gear and propellers, and they were supposed to be landed as part of this important fire support for the last lap of the landing. We trained them in Scotland in the most adverse conditions, just as well, because the conditions on D-Day, of course, were very unpleasant. But anyway, amongst those who would be with us in the LCH, therefore, was the brigadier of the armoured brigade, of which 13th, 18th Hussars was a part. And he and Commander Curry had to make the decision about launching these tanks. And so we set off, and I remember there was some cheering as ships passed each other in off Spithead, and we then went off and had a rough passage overnight, cramped, very rough and unpleasant. Somebody was sick over me, and my bodyguard was very disgusted because he said that was the only battle dress we'd gotten, so we had to go up on the deck and wash down as best we could. And then one was struck with this two incredible sights. One was the amazing armada, whichever way one looked, there were ships, craft. And the other was the way in which, as the bombardment began, the whole scene, the whole horizon seemed to lift up in the air. And I suppose one felt a pang of sympathy for the people who were at the other end, but we were going to be there shortly ourselves. And so we made our way forward towards the beach, and then as the first flight of landing craft started to come back, Commander Curry said it was probably time we went ashore, so that was rather undue cheerfulness, I thought, and Colonel and I loaded ourselves into a landing craft, although it had got, I think it probably had a wounded man on board. We'd dismissed several others because they were carrying wounded, and we turned this craft round, and the Corporal Coxon drove us ashore. The hazard, chief hazard at that stage, were the beach obstacles, which were fitted with mines or fused shells, and you had to manoeuvre between them in rather a nasty lop waves. And then we beached. Well, we didn't beach very well because we jumped off the ramp of the craft, and the Colonel and I were both over 6 foot, so we were able to help our bodyguards, who were rather smaller, because one thing you mustn't do is fall down at that stage, because it's very difficult to get up again with the load you're carrying. And we shook ourselves and looked around. To the left of the beach there were two craft, which again I haven't mentioned the specific one. These were tanks which were not intended to be mobile. They were loaded into these craft, and they provided another means of fire support, and they were to be on the flank, and they were manned by the Royal Marines artillery section. and they were on fire, I think both of them. There were craft which were beached, there were bodies lying about, and the general impression I have is one of greyness, whether it's a result of smoke and the weather and spray, and but general impression is one of being rather a grey day. There was some small arms fire, but I think most of the activity was from mortars and field artillery, and one just had to start to establish some kind of organisation. Beach signs had to be erected, and certainly some of them had been dropped by casualties, and they had to be recovered and taken to their proper place. And I stopped to talk to my immediate superior, who had come ashore with the assault wave, although he was not supposed to, and he'd been wounded, and I stopped to talk to him, and I didn't see the colonel I'd landed with until we found his body that evening with his bodyguard just a few yards further up the beach, and they'd evidently been killed by a mortar, although they were not obviously marked.
Which beach is this?
This is Sword Beach, eastern flank. I'm beginning to dry up.
Can we clarify what Force S is, please?
Yes, I should have explained that the Allied Naval Expeditionary Force consisted of five forces, and they to provide the landing element on five beaches, and these were Utah and Omaha, which were very largely American beach assault forces, although you must remember that the majority of the landing craft and ships were British or Canadian, regardless of what the troops, the vehicles they were carrying. The British sector consisted of Gold Beach and Juno and Sword. So we had Force S, Force J, and Force G. Force S, as I've said, was a naval force with the 3rd British Infantry Division. Force J had its naval component, which was to land the 3rd Canadian Division, and the Gold Beach Force, Force G, was to land the 50th Northumbrian Division, who had come, as you will appreciate, from the Mediterranean campaign. It's quite interesting because the 3rd Division, British Division, hadn't been actively employed since Dunkirk. The 3rd Canadian Division had no doubt components employed at Dieppe, and 50th Northumbrian Division had been heavily engaged right through the North African campaign, Sicily and Italy. And there are interesting studies to be done about the state of morale in the different forces. I was in hospital with men from the 50th Division, and they were not very well disposed to Field Marshal Montgomery, as they felt they were harshly treated by being constantly in the front line. But however, I mustn't be diverted onto that for the moment. Just to recapitulate, therefore, we have these five assault forces, all under the command of Admiral Sir Bertram Ramsay, the Allied Commander of Naval Expeditionary Force. he was supported in turn by Vice Admiral Sir Philip Vaughan on the British sector, and by an American admiral whose name escapes me at this moment, in the American sector, with appropriate bombarding ships added for the operation, who provided heavy fire support from battleships, cruisers and destroyers.
Can we talk about your own personal role on the beach now, as
yes.
beachmaster?
Yes.
What it involved?
Yes.
What were your duties?
Yes. The duty of the beach commanders, they originated from simple beach parties, as we were called when I first joined in 1941. We had a minimum of training, as I tried to describe, and subsequently there was a proper school set up at Ardentini, HMS Armadillo, which was the Royal Naval Commando Training Centre in the Clyde area. The task of the beach group, which was the military element, centred on an infantry battalion and had added to it engineer, medical, transport, RAF and naval components to enable it to carry out all the necessary duties of receiving men and vehicles from landing craft and ships, clearing them through the beach exits into transit areas, and either then to storage depots or through to the operational front. So the naval beach party element of this, which subsequently was called beach commando, was to provide navigational marks to assist in the clearance of obstacles below the high water mark, to mark any obstructions they could see, and generally to provide the incoming landing craft with as much guidance as possible, and to expedite the unloading of them, their personnel, vehicles or stores, and clear them off the beach as quickly as possible.
So what actually happened, how did that job go for you on D-Day itself?
Well, it was very, it was much as always, it's never straightforward. Things don't normally go particularly well in exercise, and they go even it doesn't help when you're being shot at as well. But the point is that the we had considerable difficulty in clearing the vehicles off the beach in our area, partly because of mining by the Germans, and partly simply that we were victims of our own success in getting a large amount of stuff ashore, and the exits were ill-suited to the volume of traffic we could provide. But mines were one of the chief hazards, and of course vehicles do break down or drown, as the expression is. You can also create quicksands with some due to gunfire. The sand can actually be made into a quicksand, and that provides another hazard. But we had to close our beach for a period because of the difficulty of dispersing the vehicles away from the beach area into their to their respective tasks, and then we picked up again in the afternoon. The difficulty, I better put this as a general sideline, I think. 19 days later I was wounded in the head, and I've often wondered if that has created a vacuum in my memory, because I notice that people write biographical, autobiographical tales, and one thinks how amazing that they have all this detail at their fingertips. And a lot of this is a complete blank as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I can remember various episodes, such as the time when there were still snipers about, and 48 hours after we'd landed. And somebody was cleaning his rifle, and he did the elementary thing of not making sure there wasn't one in the breech, and there was one, and he pulled the trigger, and the bullet went from the back of the beach to the front of the beach. There are houses in the middle, and the chap on the front of the beach said, "Cool, it was a sniper." So he and a couple of his mates proceeded to return fire in the direction they thought this bullet had come from, whereupon the people at the back of the beach assumed that they were being attacked by snipers, and so an exchange of fire took place. And then, to add to the fun of the fair, a landing craft flak, that is one of the ships I mentioned which had Erlikons and Bofors and pom-poms fitted, joined in and opened fire, and we had some difficulty in getting peace talks going by demanding a ceasefire. The worst of it was that an ammunition lorry blew up, which didn't help at all. So this was all pure accident, and just has to be put down as one of the inevitabilities of war. There were some casualties as a consequence of this. One thing I haven't mentioned is something which now does occur to me. There were, of course, people who found the landing very stressful. I remember there was a group of military policemen who were lurking behind an armoured vehicle, and I encouraged them to go off about their business. And I don't know how to put this as politely as possible, but anyway, they needed some encouragement. But also, I met two men, and I'd never seen this before or since. These two men were blue with fear. You've heard of people in a blue funk, but this is something I'd never seen. And so, again, they had to be encouraged and to take a grip on themselves. It was no worse for them than it was for anybody else. And it's just that is the way it's taken them. And I'm sure that they got on very well thereafter.
How did you feel yourself?
Oh, I felt a great sense of relief. I'd been training for this for 3 years, and the one thing I'd been afraid of was that I would not be fit on the day that we went across. And so I was, it sounds ridiculous, but I was delighted and very proud to be ashore, a part of this great thing which I'd been involved with for the last 3 years. Because all that I'd been doing was related to this end. It wasn't the end of the war by any manner of means, but it was something which had to be done, and which we'd actually been interested in since 1940, but I was actively involved from 1941. And I didn't have any, I wasn't conscious of any particular expectation that I was going to be a casualty, although I was hit by odd bits, but they were mostly splinters and so on, and there were casualties to be seen in one's immediate vicinity. You have a feeling of invulnerability to some extent.
Did any enemy aircraft come over on D-Day?
Not as I recall, particularly on D-Day. We had a couple of raids the following day and the day after, and one we were quite successful. I've actually met one of the battery in which brought this aircraft down, and he lives in Salisbury, and I've been able to talk to him. But this aircraft was brought down more or less on top of us, which was more than we wanted, and it had butterfly bombs. They were anti-personnel bombs, and so they were rather scattered around as a result of the explosion of the aircraft, and that was an added hazard that had to be coped with by the Royal Engineers. We had in fact been issued with a pair of shotguns. Now I come to think, I can't think where the ammunition was, but anyway, we had these shotguns, and they were intended to for us to shoot at these butterfly bombs as they came down. As the aircraft had released them in a proper way, they would have floated down, and then we discovered that their lethal range was inside that of the range of the shotgun, so it wasn't very satisfactory to shoot at them. But the aircraft, no, I think you would say that we really made a rod for our own back, because we provided most appalling smoke screen at night. Why at night? I can't imagine. It was dreadful, and we had to stagger around, and if you wanted to sleep, you probably had to wear a gas mask, because it was really very noxious, and I'm sure it did far more harm to us than it did to the enemy. Because I don't think that we were providing many visual targets.
That was on D-Day night itself.
And thereafter, other nights besides. There was a very tense night, I can remember, when the enemy was about to make a counterattack, or was counterattacking, and so much so that the beach sub area commander ordered work to stop on the beach, but I went and represented that this was not a very good idea, as we'd got ammunition for the fighting troops, and it was not much point having it stuck on the beach, and much better to get it moving. So, but that was a tense moment, because our beach was on the eastern flank, as I've explained, and it would have been most unsatisfactory. That had been overrun, because we were providing one of the sources of supply, which would be replaced eventually by the Mulberry. But the Mulberry took some time to construct, that is the artificial harbour. We didn't have an artificial harbour on our beach, all we had was a row of block ships who provided some kind of shelter for a landing craft and to make the beach slightly less subject to the vagaries of the weather. And the other thing, of course, which requires to be mentioned, is the great storm, which lasted for 3 or 4 days and really was an appalling disaster. It could have been most catastrophic. Fortunately, the British Mulberry managed to continue operation, but we couldn't operate at all for those days, because the beaches were unusable, and we had every kind of shipwreck along the beach, and lots of survivors from craft and barges that had sunk.
Can you describe how you came to be wounded, please?
We were shelled at regular intervals in rather Germanic fashion, as far as I remember, morning and evening, and high water and low water, and if we had a suitable target. As on one occasion when we had several LSTs came in, landing ship tank, that's the big landing ships, and they were a fruitful target for the enemy. And then we had an ammunition ship which came in, and that attracted targets, so that went on fire, and it can't have been full of ammunition, otherwise it